talk is about subsidence in Hurricane Eye. And unfortunately, I got laryngitis the other day. But one of my co-authors here, Chris Rozoff, who's sitting right over here, is volunteered to jump up here and continue to talk if my voice gives out. So this started by trying to explain some things that have been observed over a period of many, many years. One is called hub clouds, and one is called molds, and the other one is warm ring structure. And these things date back to the mid-50s and early 60s. This paper by Robert Simpson, who was former director of the National Hurricane Center. Simpson and Starrett wrote this paper in 55 that described hub clouds and moats. And then this paper, which is an analysis of YouTube photographs, had real nice illustrations of moats. And then this paper here by Noel Sir and Harry Hawkins, first described, as far as we could tell, warm ring structures. So what are these things? This is the schematic diagram that Simpson and Starrett published in their 55 paper. And this is a hurricane of 1954. And this is a schematic diagram that they drew for a cross-section. And this is the eye wall right here and right here. And then they noticed that there was a clear region around the edge of the eye. They called that the moat. And then they noticed there was a somewhat deeper convection, but not above about 700 millibars or 10,000 feet or something like that. And they called that the hub cloud, like the hub of a wheel. And by the way, in later literature, the term moat is used quite differently. It's used to denote the region between the inner eye wall and the outer eye wall. And in that case, it's a radar-free region. This so-called inner mode, or eye mode, is actually a cloud-free region. And this is the plan view of that. So when you look down at the eye, you see these clear regions around the edge of the eye, and then this hub cloud in the center.
Excuse me, may I ask a question? I notice on your two hub walls, they're very different in shape. The one on the left is more up and down, and the other one has a gentle rise.
Yeah.
Is that the effect of Coriolis force, or what is that?
That happened to be the structure of this particular storm. And you see it all different ways. I mean, sometimes they can tilt out very strongly, 45 degrees or something like that, all the way around. Sometimes one side can be more upright. It's probably very much related to the environmental vertical shear that the storm is embedded in. Okay, now, this is from Fletcher's paper, 1961. And this was a YouTube photograph of Typhoon Ida, September 1958. And YouTube flies at about 65,000 feet. And so this is looking down into the eye of Ida. And this is the eye wall around here. So this is a cumulonimbus cloud, very deep cloud. And then this is the moat at the edge of the eye, and this is the hub cloud in here. Now, in this paper by Fletcher and Boongard et al., they had an interesting interpretation of why this air is clear here. They had some kind of quote like it's a downdraft, dry downdraft air that has gouged out the cloudiness at the edge of the eye. I think this was very perceptive because this diagram came along many years later, 1984, a paper by David Jorgensen. And this is Hurricane Allen, the famous hurricane in August 1980. And by this time, there were two NOAA P3 aircraft, and you could fly radial legs at multiple levels. And this happens to have six levels here. And Jorgensen used the the inelastic form of the continuity equation to compute vertical velocity from the radial velocity measurements, assuming that the storm is axisymmetric. And what he got is about a 7 meter per second updraft here at a radius 30 to 40 kilometers. And then he got very strong subsidence just inside this eyewall updraft here. This is subsidence of about 3 meters per second and much weaker subsidence in the center. So this fits with Boomgaard and Fletcher's interpretation.
So that's the Asmussen average mean updraft at 6 meters a second.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Seven. Maybe about seven or something like that. Now, warm rings. As far as we could tell, this is the first paper of Sir Hawkins, 63, this analysis of Hurricane Cleo that happened in 1958. And this is aircraft at three different levels. Here, 800 millibars, 560 millibars, and they actually had a high-level jet aircraft at this time. So this is up here around 250 millibars. And what Le Sueur and Hawkins plotted here is the temperature anomaly. So they drew isolines of the temperature anomaly. So you just take the temperature and subtract from it a far-field temperature as a function of height. So that these are deviation temperatures from a far-field value. And it shows the warm core structure here. This is 11 degrees warmer than the surroundings at that level. But the interesting thing they showed here is, at least on these two flight levels, that the warmest air was at the edge of the eye. So these isotherms go like this. They didn't see that so much at the upper level. But this is the first indication of what's called a warm ring structure. So the warmest air is not right in the center. It's on the edge of the eye.
Well, it's not very big, though, is it? Judging from that, it's probably only a fraction of a degree. It's not big.
Maybe not big here. I'll show some other ones later from more modern observations that'll have some values of that, how warm it is in the ring. Probably better illustrations than this. So our idea was to try to see if we could fit these different things, modes, hub clouds, and warm rings together. We don't have a complete theory of it, but we have a kind of a diagnostic argument of how it makes sense. And it's based on a balanced vortex model. So you assume that it's axisymmetric and it's inviscid, so we're not concerned with the boundary layer structure. It's hydrostatic, and in the radial direction it's gradient balanced. And here we're going to use log pressure as the vertical coordinate, where that capital H is just a constant scale height. So here's the balanced vortex model. This is the gradient balance formula, and in this, we have neglected the material derivative of u. U is the radial velocity. So this is a gradient wind balance. This is the tangential wind formula. And there's no pressure gradient term here because you've assumed it's axisymmetric. This is the hydrostatic balance. This is the continuity equation. It may look a little funny with this last term here, but that comes out because of the use of this log pressure coordinate. And then here's the thermodynamic equation, with Q being the diabatic heating and W being the vertical log pressure velocity. Now, the way it's written here, it has two prediction equations, one for V and one for T. But that's probably not the correct way to look at it, because temperature is related to geopotential through this formula. So you can think about this as predicting the vertical derivative of geopotential. And this V here is related to the radial derivative of geopotential. So it's possible to eliminate the tendency of geopotential between these two equations. And then you'll get a diagnostic equation without any time derivatives in it. So the way you do that is first you use the continuity equation to define a stream function psi for the transverse circulation. So remember, u is radial velocity, w is vertical velocity. So you define u in terms of the z derivative of psi, and w in terms of the radial derivative of r psi. And then if you plug that in there, it'll be automatically satisfied. So you basically exchange two variables, uw, for a single variable, psi, your stream function for the transverse circulation. Now, here's the thermal wind equation. The thermal wind equation is derived from the gradient and hydrostatic equations. And you just take the vertical derivative of the gradient formula and then use the hydrostatic formula. And you can come up with this gradient wind balance. This relates the vertical derivative of the tangential wind to the radial derivative of the temperature. Now, if you take the local time derivative of this, you get this formula here. And this tells you that the local tendency of tangential wind and the local tendency of temperature are constrained to always obey this. So let's figure out the equation for the local time derivative of temperature and the local time derivative of tangential wind. And you can write it this way. And here you've used this radial derivative of psi here for w, the vertical velocity, and use this vertical derivative of psi right there and right there for the radial velocity. And when you write it this way, there's three coefficients, a, b, and c. And a here is the static stability. Basically, it's the deviation of the actual lapse rate from the adiabatic lapse rate. And then this is the baroclinity. You can either interpret it as the vertical derivative of the tangential wind or the radial derivative of temperature. These two are the same because of the thermal wind equation. And then finally, this C is the inertial stability. It's a product of the absolute vorticity here. And this is the average absolute vorticity inside the radius R. Now, all you have to do now is take the radial derivative of this equation and the vertical derivative of this equation, and you can eliminate these two tendency equations. And this is the celebrated Sawyer-Eliasson equation, derived about more than 50 years ago now. And this is the equation. So you can think of this as a second order equation for the stream function, which is on the left-hand side, in terms of the adiabatic heating, which is on the right-hand side. And the three coefficients, A, B, and C, appear in there. Now, this equation is elliptic if AC minus B squared is positive, and we're going to assume that throughout here. And so the boundary conditions you need for this elliptic equation, you need them at the bottom, the top, the center, and the far field. And here are the boundary conditions that we're going to use. Just psi at zero all the way from the top, the center, and the bottom. And then r times psi goes to zero as r goes to infinity. Now, this equation is quite complicated to solve because these coefficients, A, B, C, can have very complicated spatial structures in the real hurricane. So we're going to make some drastic simplifications here just to try to get some physical principles down. So we're going to consider this idealized vortex in which the static stability A is this exponential function times a constant. So n squared is the square of the root of isolated frequency. Let's assume constant. We'll assume that the vortex is barotropic, so B is zero. And then the inertial stability here we're going to write this way, where F hat is the effective Coriolis parameter defined this way. So you take the absolute vorticity here, multiply it by this average absolute vorticity inside R, and then take the square root of that. That's the effective Coriolis parameter. And this barotropic assumption makes that F hat a function of R only. That's an important simplification. So when you do that, the Sawyer-Eliasson equation goes to this. You lose the cross derivative terms R and Z. So still, it's a second order equation, two R derivatives, two Z derivatives here, with this forcing on the right-hand side. And now we're going to assume that the the solutions and the forcing over here are separable. So the hat variables are functions of R, and then the vertical dependence is in this exponential and a sine. So this is like the first internal mode of PD. So if you put these assumptions in there, you can reduce that PDE to an ordinary differential equation. And this is the ordinary differential equation here. And it has this quantity mu squared here, and that the quantity mu is the effective Coriolis parameter divided by the Brun-Weissler frequency, which is a constant, and then multiplied by this group of constants here. And this is the inverse Rossby length. So we are particularly interested in the important role played by radial variations of this mu. Now, still this is a little complicated to solve if mu varies in a complicated way with R. So we're going to make another idealization to this barotropic vortex. And that is, we're going to assume that the tangential wind V as a function of R can be defined in this piecewise way. This is actually the eye, this is the eye wall, and this is the far field. And when you make this assumption and you figure out what the effective Coriolis parameter is, you find that it's this piecewise constant here, where f hat 0, f hat 1, f hat 2 are constants that appear in this formula. Now, the advantage of doing that is then that that coefficient there becomes a constant. So now we also assume that the heating is confined to the eye wall region. So here's the eye between R equals 0 and R1. So there's no heating there. And it's a far field, R2 to infinity. There's no heating there. But in the eye wall, this Q hat of R is assumed to be a constant. And it would appear that there's three parameters here, R1, R2, and this Q1. But we've chosen not to vary them all independently, but to have R1, R2, and Q1 satisfy this constraint here. So the way you can think of it is, if you have eye walls of different widths and different radii, they all give essentially the same rainfall rate. So now what you have is that the radial structure equation reduces to this. Remember, the right-hand side had the radial derivative of the heating. But the heating now is a step function, so its derivative is zero except the edges of the step function, and the Rossby length is constant in each of the three regions. So this is the equation that applies in each region, and of course the right hand side, which was dQ dr, is infinite at the edges of the heating. So really what you need to do is replace that by these jump conditions. So what's going to happen is your stream function is going to be continuous at the inner edge and the outer edge of the eye wall. But the stream function itself is going to have a kink in it. And the magnitude of that kink is determined by Q1 of the heating. So these are the jump conditions at the inner edge and the outer edge of the eye wall. Now, that's a modified Bessel equation. So with our heating profile, the solutions are simply the first order modified Bessel functions. First order because of that one right there. So just to remind you, here's the modified Bessel functions. Here is I1, and here is K1. And we also put the zero order modified Bessel functions. Those will come up in a minute. So here's the stream function solution. In the I, it goes like an I1 Bessel function of R multiplied by the inverse Rossby length in the I. And since this argument of this I1 is a constant, this thing in the denominator is just a number. So this gives the radial structure here. And then, so what you've done is you've thrown out the K1 Bessel function in the I because it blows up at the center. And here is in the far field, you only have the K1 Bessel function there. That's the one that damps. You threw out the I1, the one that grows. And then in the eye wall, this center region, you have to have both of them. So it's most compactly written in terms of this F, which has I1 and K1 in it. Anyway, there's two constants in here, psi hat 1 and psi hat 2, and those are determined by the two jump conditions. And the solution for psi is continuous at the edges of the eye wall. Now, to figure out what the vertical motion is, all you have to do is differentiate r times the stream function. So that means you have to know these derivatives of I1 and K1. And those derivatives are given in terms of the I0 and K0 Bessel functions. So when you figure out the radial structure of the vertical motion, it comes out like this. In terms of the I0 Bessel function in I, the K0 in the far field, and a combination of the two in the center region. Now, once you have the vertical motion, you can go back to the thermodynamic equation and figure out what the tendency of temperature would be. Hat means the radial structure of the temperature tendency. And since there's no radial advection, that temperature tendency is just determined by the diaphragmatic heating and the vertical advection here against this static stability squared. So anyway, we have a solution for this now, and we can plug that in there, and we can get this formula for the tendency. I don't want to go over this formula, just we'll see a plot of this here. So here are four different vortices labeled A through D here. A and B are titans that have a radius of maximum here, 20 kilometers. C and D are, it's bigger, it's out here at 40 kilometers. And the A one, like this, is Rankine-like. And B, this one here, is U-shaped-like. And same thing for C and D, but a larger radius. Now, if you look at A and B here, the effective Coriolis parameter in the eye divided by the Coriolis parameter is 141 for A, and it's 41 for B. So the vortices that are Rankine-like, they have a higher vorticity in the eye, and therefore they will have smaller Rossbergs in the eye. Now, if we plot the solution for the vertical velocity, that's this thing right here. This solid one here is for A, and this dashed one here is for B. Now, the thing about B is that it is a dynamically small eye. The thing about A is it's a dynamically large eye, where you measure the size of the eye in terms of the Rossby length. So we said that this Rankine-like one has a much smaller Rossby length than the eye. So because the Rossby length is so small, the physical size of the eye, which is only 10 kilometers here, the physical size of it looks large. And if the physical size of it looks large, the vertical velocity will significantly vary. Let me go back to this. See, it all depends. This is the vertical velocity here, and this is the I0 Bessel function. So what really matters is the range of that mu0 r. So if that if the range of that argument is large, you will need a significant part of this I0 curve. If the range of that is very small, you'll only need this much of the curve. So that determines how much variation there is in the subsidence rate in the eye. So.
So when I was looking, when you look at this, you have the three-part hurricane, right? You have the outer, you have the eye wall, and you have the eye.
Right.
And you can see that in your U-shaped velocity profile. For the Rankine ones, you just impose that somewhere else. You don't see that in the tangential wind.
Right.
The distinction between the eye and the eye wall.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes.
And so that's just coming because of how you're specifying the heating. And that's why you see it in, for instance, the, you know, that 10 kilometers is specified in your vertical velocity solution.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
Is that how to interpret that?
Yes. The diabatic heating is between 10 and 20 kilometers in A and B. And the diabatic heating is between 30 and 40 in C and D. And the diabatic heating has been normalized to give the same rainfall. So since this ring is bigger, has more area, it has smaller diabatic heating, and therefore it produces smaller vertical motion. But the interesting thing is that if it's a dynamically small eye, the subsidence is uniform in the eye. If it's a dynamically large eye, the subsidence is weaker in the center and strong at the edge. And then when you figure out the temperature tendency, you get this thing right here. This is temperature tendency in kelvins per hour as against radius. And this solid one here corresponds to this solid curve, and this dashed one here corresponds to this one. So because the subsidence rate is small in the center of the eye here, the temperature tendency is smaller. And here, where you have a large subsidence at the edge of the eye, the temperature tendency is large. So you would expect that to give rise to a warm ring structure. Now, here's an interesting picture. This is a hurricane that Mike was talking about this morning, Hurricane Isabel. And this picture was taken by Sim Aberson. And the way you have to imagine this is the plane is on the edge of the eye wall over here. And the eye wall is sloping down towards the ocean like this. And this is the center of the eye right in here. And this part out here is the eye wall on the other side of the eye. And it's about 60 kilometers away. So it doesn't look very much higher than this. This thing right here is only about 3 kilometers in height. And this part over here is 15 kilometers in height. So this over here, the convection is 5 times deeper than here. But because of the angle, this hub cloud here looks deeper than it really is. Or the far edge of the eye wall doesn't look as deep as it really is. But anyway, the interesting thing about this is you can see the moat right in here. And presumably that goes all the way around this hub cloud here. This is the best picture I think I've ever seen.
Could I point out something about that picture, which has been pointed out many times before about similar forms, but bears on part of your problem, is that if you look at the eye wall on the right-hand side in the background, you see this veil at the top, a veil of ice crystals. And you can also see an extension of that down lower. And the phenomenon that has been remarked, yes, is that there's often a cascade of such ice crystals down the inner side of the eye wall, leading one to think that there might be an awful lot of evaporation going on
yes.
there that might contribute to that maximum downdraft loss.
Right, which is completely missing from the argument that we're giving here. Yes, I think that's an important point.
If you've got this hub cloud that's convective there, you assume that the largest that you've got large low level instability near the center, and you get this hub cloud, could this moat not be the sort of region of compensating substance for the hub cloud and nothing to do with the eye? Just occurred to me.
So yeah, you're suggesting that the origin of this the region here could be compensating subsidence for that.
That's right, because you may have large instability near the surface because the P3s are large near the surface, but you've got a capping immersion.
Yeah, at the top of that.
Because of the main part of the eye, so the thing is trying to convect, but it can't go very high.
But our square works against you.
Yeah.
If your convecting region is on the outside, then you're subsiding into a smaller region. Whereas if you're convecting on the inside, you're subsiding into a broader region. So from the mass budget view, it's unfavorable.
Yes, our argument has the diabetic heating in the eye is zero. So
yeah, right.
It does not
I understand that.
It doesn't have any
late
heat release there.
I'm suggesting what happens if you have some diabetic heating
there
near the center.
That's interesting.
Because then you could envisage that you would have a circulation.
Yeah, that's an interesting possibility.
Maybe you could do that calculation as well with an extra little
region in there. Yeah.
Region in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Roger, you were asking about the strength of the worm ring structure. I think this is maybe a better example than that one from Lesur and Hawkins. This one is from Isabel. And there's two levels here. This panel here is 2.1 kilometers. And this one is 3.7 kilometers. And what's shown here, this is radius out to 60 kilometers. This is tangential wind, which is for this curve right here. And then this is temperature here, which is for this curve, which is the temperature, and this curve, which is the dew point. So the way you can imagine this is an airplane flies in, and it gets into the eye wall, and it's in cloud, so the temperature and the dew point are the same here. And then the plane breaks. It looks like it tried to break through the eye wall there, and maybe it got some more eye wall there. But anyway, from this point inward, you're in the eye, and the temperature goes up, and the dew point goes down. So this is quite a spread in temperature dew point. I think it's about 7 or 8 degrees Celsius there. And then it shows here that the warmest part is at the edge of the eye right there. And it is about, let's say that's about 15, and that right there is about 11. So it's about 4 degrees warmer at the edge of the eye than in the center in this case. And this is the same thing here at this lower level. So we know that. Well, I think we're fairly sure that worm ring structure can exist in the lower troposphere. What happens to it when you get to the upper troposphere is not quite clear about. I wouldn't be surprised if it goes to a warm core structure and that worm ring does not extend all the way up into the upper troposphere.
Well, the fact that the real vortex is parathin probably has a big effect there.
Yes. So here's the conclusions. There is less than 10% horizontal variation in the subsidence in the eye when the ratio of eye radius to Rossby length in the eye is less than 0.6. So those are called dynamically small eyes. Even though they may be large on physical size, they are dynamically small. The subsidence rate at the edge of the eye is more than twice as strong as that at the center of the eye when the ratio of eye radius to Rossby length in the eye is greater than 1.8. So these are dynamically large eyes. They're either physically large or they are eyes with very high inertial stability. The existence of a hub cloud at the center of the eye, and then this is what Carrie was mentioning, cascading pileus clouds in the upper troposphere at the edge of the eye.
What does bilious mean? I don't know that one. It's an isom.
Yes, it's a type of cloud formation which is, in its original use, was to denote clouds formed by airflow over other clouds, almost like lenticular clouds, but where a cumulus cloud is serving as the mountain in that case.
Sort of like what you see on deep convection, you see these little staggering.
Those are Pelias.
Yeah.
And this may not be a technically accurate use of that word, but it looks very similar to that.
Yeah.
Maybe they need to invent a new genera of clouds.
Do you have a section on this in your book?
No.
So, yeah, the existence of a hub cloud, and then the clear moat in the lower troposphere at the edge of the eye, and a warm ring structure, they seem to be all associated with strong inertial stability in the eye and a relatively large eye radius. So, that's the end of my talk. And if somebody wants to ask a question about is the barotropic assumption any good, I have this slide here. But my conclusion is that, I think the barotropic assumption is not misleading here. These are some diagrams that Chris made. And basically, he numerically solved the full Sawyer-Leeson equation for a barotropic vortex. So these are isolines of V as a function of height and radius. So it's barotropic, so the lines are straight up and down. So this is all barotropic in this column. And this is a baroclinic vortex. These are isolines of V. So the tangential wind gets weaker up here. So this is a full solution of the Sawyer-Leeson equation. So it has the capital B terms in the elliptic equation. And then these are the vertical motion fields that come out of that. This is the barotropic one, and this is the baroclinic one. And they are fairly similar, although the baroclinic one is shifted up. Basically, what happens, I think, is that when you make a baroclinic vortex, the theta surfaces have to dip down like this in the center. You have a warm core vortex. And so that increases the static stability at low levels and decreases the static stability at upper levels. And decreasing the static stability up there makes the vertical motion shift upward like that. There may also be some inertial stability effects in there. And then these are the associated temperature tendencies for the barotropic.
That's interesting because the temperature tendency shifts upwards with the baroclinic vortex. Whereas the picture that you showed very early on had the effect decreasing with height.
Yes. Yes. That is a puzzling.
Well, but that actually raises another interesting point, because if you're looking at Isabel on the 13th of September, and they're sort of a quasi steady state, or at least you can imagine that there's a time when they are. And these solutions, although they're steady in the stream function, imply linear tendencies in temperature and velocity. Now, if you actually insist on steady solutions, you have to satisfy the temperature and momentum equations individually as well as this. And this is the puzzle, okay, because what's balancing in the steady state what you see in the lower panels of your thing? And, of course, there's radiative cooling going on. But that, I would imagine, is pretty uniform across the eye. And the two things that occur to me might be non-uniform, the ice crystal evaporation that you talked about. But the other thing is that since you have these big radial temperature gradients in the eye and we have eddies, it's possible that there are eddy fluxes that at least locally are balancing the subsidence in certain places more than in others. And, I think a full accounting of what you see in the eye would have to deal with the thermodynamic balance as well. Well, in the substance, I don't see how that can happen because the substance is probably the best.
So I guess the point that Carrie brought up earlier is you know, this is the eye wall, and if you have bilious clouds, bilious clouds come down here, and there's evaporation, sublimation going on here, that you could have a cooling effect, which is not in this model here. And in fact, Dalin Zhang has written a paper that where he has a cooling effect just on the inside of the eye wall, and he says that that's very important. But I guess the point I want to make here is that you don't need that to get concentrated subsidence at the edge of the eye. It can just come dynamically just from the inertial stability.
Up to the point where the thermodynamic equation starts to be unhappy. We can't keep warming it up indefinitely, right?
Yeah.
And the question, the interesting question is that maybe some of these, you know, Mike in his talk, he showed pictures, you've got all this eddy activity. It's not necessarily isotropic, it might be. That might be fluxing heat out of these very warm regions of the inner edge of the eye into the eye wall and balancing that temperature tendency, then you could sustain that downward motion. That's, I think, a sort of a missing piece that has to be solved somehow.
I think these dynamically large eyes also may provide an enhanced protection of what Gary and I call the iris, which is the lower. Lower chromosphere in the eye where you're building up high entropy, and it would help maintain super intensity effect. That's a suspicion I have. The fact that it's almost as if you kind of put a lid on the eye, you're enhancing the buildup of that entropy in the low level eye, enhance the iris effect, the super intensity process. So this actually may be quite important. For these strong storms that you observe, Francis, Ivan, Katrina, Rita, they get bigger as they evolve. Their eyes get bigger, and so your substance effect may help contain that effect and keep them strong. So it may be like a protection.
So Mozart.
Correct.
Correct.
By the way, I just want to point out one other thing about Isabel here. If you interpret this as the edge of the eye in Isabel, then this is the wind structure inside the eye, which would indicate that the eye of Isabel is characterized by two different Rossby lengths, one there and one there, which is beyond this model argument here. So it might be that some of this high vorticity got mixed in from the eye wall, but the mixing wasn't strong enough to push it all the way to the center. So.
If that's just one radial length.
Yeah, here's a one at the lower level, 2.1. It shows a similar thing.
But that's just one leg going in, or is this an average of several legs?
They could do at least four or eight, but it's probably a good idea.
This is just one, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean.
But on the other hand, you can invoke the argument that a hurricane of zero order is axisymmetric. All you need is one.
Well, the thing I always talk about that is how you have that three-piece structure in the wind field and in the thermodynamic fields, because in the region where the radial gradient of the wind is increasing, that second region there, you see the dew point and the temperature diverging, and
yeah.
That sort of corresponds. You know, they stop diverging and then it goes to the other cell, but it's the same in the other figure as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it seemed like something non-trivial.
Meanwhile, what's happening in the ocean?
A lot of waves.
Surfs up.
You don't believe in ocean atmosphere interaction.
And that's been neglected here, although that's certainly a very important part of a hurricane. And I don't know, is anybody going to talk about air-sea interaction? This week?
Yes.
That is one of the most uncertain things in these models. When we do bulk aerodynamic formulas in the boundary layer, we have to come up with drag coefficients and transfer coefficients. And how those coefficients depend on wind speed at very high wind speed is very uncertain. Although I think in recent years, there's been some progress.